Greetings and welcome to the latest edition of the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Martin, and I'm happy to have you with me today as I am joined by author Jimmy Fritz, speaking about his book, Confessions of an Ethical Drug Dealer. We had a great conversation the other day, and I'm excited to bring it to you here on the podcast. Before we get to that, just a few announcements. First of all, thank you to Stefan for making a PayPal donation in support of the Entheogenic Evolution podcast. If you would like to make a PayPal donation, just stop by my personal webpage at martinball.net and use the PayPal link at the top right of the page. Also, I think I forgot to mention the other week that I have a new patron over at Patreon, and that would be Tree of Life. So thank you very much, Tree of Life, for your monthly support over at Patreon. If you would like to join up at Patreon, it's quite easy. You can go to my webpage, martinball.net, and there's a link to Patreon over there, or you just go to patreon.com/martinwball, and I have a variety of different levels that you can join up for monthly support and membership from $1 a month to $100 a month. And at the $100 level, you get a complimentary one-hour consult or check-in per month. Of course, I am still available for consultations. My schedule has actually been quite busy lately with lots of consultations with lots of people from around the world. So I'm a little bit booked out for the next couple of weeks. But if you'd like to get something scheduled, feel free to reach out, get in touch with me. You can check out my website for that, www.nondualentheogenicintegration.com. And we can set up an appointment for you, 30, 60, or 90 minutes. Also, just a quick reminder that my brand new art book, The Celestial Cathedral and Temples of Light, is now out and available. I just got my completed copies just the other day. I'm going to send one to my mom, send one to my dad, and keep one for me. I think it came out really well. I'm really happy with the art and the quality of the print. It's out there on all the Amazon marketplaces. It's also available as a Kindle ebook if you just want to look at it on the computer screen or on your tablet. I wouldn't recommend a phone. That'd be kind of boring. The art would be pretty small, but, you know, an iPad, that'd be cool. Also, the companion musical album is fully out now as well. It is also titled Temples of Light, and it is distributed out there under the artist name of Orobai, which is O-R-O-B-A-I. But it's my album, my music, and it goes with the book, The Celestial Cathedral and Temples of Light. Just to give you an idea of what's coming up soon here on the Entheogenic Evolution podcast, I do have an interview with Brad Adams and Paul Lysy from the Los Angeles Medicinal Plant Society that I've been sitting on for well over the past month. And it regards the original video that they made of me that caused such an uproar with Symposia and their hysterical, irrational reactions to me. And Brad had asked me to sit on the interview until after his upcoming symposium, no association with Symposia, but the Los Angeles Medicinal Plant Society Symposium, which is happening this coming weekend in Los Angeles. And he wanted the interview to come out afterwards because, as we all know, Symposia is a fucking headache, and he didn't want to have to deal with them along with putting on his event. So I do have that interview. It's rather lengthy. I think it's about an hour and a half with Brad and Paul. And I've just been sitting on it, waiting to get it out there, and that'll be coming up very soon on the podcast once their event is all done. Also, coming up soon on the Entheogenic Evolution podcast, we don't have a date set, but I will be interviewing David Carpenter, whose name you might recognize. He has been writing for Forbes magazine and doing a lot of articles about 5-MeO-DMT, and he's also working on a book on the subject. And he's going to be a guest here on the old podcast coming up sometime in the next few weeks. So looking forward to that. And also going to be doing an interview with spiritual teacher Artem Boystov, B-O-Y-T-S-O-V. It looks like a Russian name. I'm totally mispronouncing it, I am sure. But Artem and I are going to have a conversation and put it out here on the podcast. So various guests coming up, along with continuing to put out chapters and selections from my memoir, Being Infinite. Hope you're enjoying that. Of course, all my books, well, not all of them, but many of my books are available as audiobooks out there on Audible and over at Amazon. I'm currently 2/3 of the way through of making the audiobook for the Entheological Paradigm 2021 edition. So looking to hopefully wrap that up within the next few weeks here, but that is in production. Things are going well. So look for that soon. Well, that's enough for introductions. Let's go ahead and get into the interview. Again, my guest is Jimmy Fritz. He's the author of Confessions of an Ethical Drug Dealer. It's a great book. I'm sure you'll enjoy the conversation. Talk to you next week. Bye.
Well, good afternoon to you.
Yeah, good afternoon to you. Nice to meet you. Congratulations on your new book, too.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I really enjoyed reading your book.
Good.
I just had a great, great time with it. And looking forward to talking to you all about it today. And, you know, we can start anywhere you like, just so you know. I've already hit record, so this will be part of the podcast right here. Unless, okay. If there's anything that you, seems like you're kind of an open book, you know, not.
Yeah.
Yeah. So your book is Confessions of an Ethical Drug Dealer, a psychedelic travel log and memoir. And, you know, I've never traveled very much. I've mostly been kind of a homebody through my life. And so really enjoyed vicariously getting to experience all these different places and all the different travels. And, well, you've really done a lot of different things while being an ethical drug dealer. And it's just a great story. And there's so many insights along the way. But let's just start with where you are now, and then we can kind of work backwards into, you know, what's in the book and all of that. And you've said you're retired, so maybe we can start with that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm living a much more quiet life these days, not doing so much traveling. I felt like I really did enough traveling. I don't really have a great longing to you know, go everywhere anymore. There's not too many places that I haven't been to that I wanted to go to. And so, and of course with COVID, there's been no travel anyway, but I've been going back to England a few times recently. But apart from that, no, I'm not into big trips anymore and traveling for months on the road and that type of thing.
Yeah, well, it seems like it's both invigorating and exhausting too at the same time.
Yes, yeah, and looking back on some of those trips and some of those expeditions, I'm exhausted too, just writing about them. So yeah, no, I'm living a more of a quiet life now. I have a really tight community in the arts community here, and you know, we still do a lot of socializing and a lot of sort of social gatherings and whatnot. We're involved in the, you know, theater and music and art and, you know, the community. So that keeps us pretty busy.
Yeah. Well, that's something that really stood out in your book is just how involved you have been. I mean, you talk about how you got into raves. So then you started promoting raves and you got into film. And so you got into that. And it's just like you've done so many different things. It's just such an interesting life story. I mean, the follow through story or the through story is the drug dealing that occurred all along the way.
Right.
But you just seem very bold about, well, I want to try that, so I'm going to do that. And I want to do that, so I'm going to do that. And you just did it.
For me, it's always been that simple, you know. It's always been that simple. I think once I make up my mind to do something, then I just, every decision I make from that point on is one step closer to that goal.
Yeah.
So, and I think a lot of people just get distracted, you know, from what they want to do. So they're on a path, they know where they want to get to, but they get distracted on the way. And I tend to, you know, once I have an idea to do something, whether it's a film or writing a song or a book or a trip or whatever, I just have the whole thing mapped out in my brain in one go. And then I just take the first step and then just keep walking towards it.
Yeah.
That's the whole formula.
Yeah, that's usually what I tell people when they ask me about writing a book. I just tell them, well, you know, get a plan for what you want your book to say and then just start, you know, take the first step and then other things will fall into place. And, you know, throughout your life story that you have here, you know, you've worked some straight jobs, but, you know, you also reflect on how having the access to money through the drug dealing really gave you opportunity to pursue all these different things in life. And that, you know, money is not the root of all evil, that it actually does give us freedom, gives us opportunities and allows for a certain level of comfort. And, ability to explore within our lives, and it seems like you really embrace that.
Yeah, exactly. And I think a lot of people, you know, they have a negative view of money. They have poverty consciousness. They think of money as the root of all evil, and it's filthy and it's dirty and blah blah blah. And profits is a dirty word. And I've never thought that. I've always thought that money is money buys you freedom. Money buys you, you know, everything you need, really, you know, for a good life. And so and you can share it too. I mean, if you feel guilty about having too much money, it's not a problem to get rid of some.
Yeah.
So that's the smallest problem with having money is, you know, giving it away. You can, it's easy to give it away. And I've always been very generous with my friends and stuff, and give to charities and whatnot. So I've always felt like I've managed money ethically. I haven't like hoarded it and taken it out of the system like a lot of the, you know, big players do, like millionaires and billionaires. They suck all the money out of the system and then it doesn't get used for anything. They just sit on it.
Yeah, this sort of deep attachment to just wanting more and wanting more and wanting more.
Yeah, it becomes an obsession. And, you know, my philosophy has always been get it flowing, get it flowing in and flowing out and keep it moving and have it, you know, do some positive things.
Yeah.
And you can help people with money, too. People are in trouble. People get behind on the rent, whatever. You can help people do those things. It's satisfying and it's rewarding.
Yeah. So with this book here, so I gather from having read the book, and again, just really, really enjoyed reading this book. It really was a pleasure. I want you to know that. I want the audience to know that so that they can go out and read the book. It really was a pleasure to read the book. You do mention in there about how when you were in the rave scene that you ended up writing a book about that. But what made you decide that you wanted to tell your life story in this particular memoir?
Well, I guess it's always been on the cards. It was always in the back of my mind that I would write, because it's something that's been a constant throughout my, you know, since I was 15. It's always been a constant, the use, not just buying and selling, but using and exploring life through the psychedelic experience. So that's been a constant, and that's reflected through everything I've done, whether it's been movies or music or books or writing. It's always been that's always been the through line. So I always felt in the back of my mind that would be a book that I would write, would be Confessions of an Ethical Drug Dealer, and that would be, you know, that's through line, provided the story, really, that I hung everything on. So everything, all the events are chosen because of their connection to that or their influence through that.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of stuff that isn't in this book too. That was the most difficult thing about writing it, is like, well, when I started listing all the events and you know, things that happened and places and people, it was so many that I had to really be brutal about paring it down and just hit the, I tried to choose stories which reflected a certain philosophical point or a, you know, made a point about something, and then strung them together as a series of high points. But there's a lot of events that aren't in there because they didn't have anything directly to do with psychedelics. So that was the theme, the through line with psychedelics.
Yeah, and I really like how many of the chapters kind of alternate between a story about travel or a story about an event, and then sometimes you just have short chapters kind of reflecting on things and kind of giving your perspective, and really your perspective is kind of integrated all the way through. I personally really love all the commentary that you have in there, and something that I wanted to ask you about, and maybe it's kind of jumping the gun a little bit, but you do talk about how you yourself had been kind of into spirituality, and you mentioned like previously being into astrology or things like that, but that at some point, and that's not quite clear in the book, about at some point you really changed your mind on all of that. And I love the outright skepticism and just kind of raw realist take you have. Like the description you have of going to India, I mean, it's just like, wow, it's really ballsy to put it that way. But I loved it. I love that take. So I don't know if you want to comment on that now. Like, what changed for you in your own perspective that then is communicated here through this book?
Well, I guess, in my younger years, like through my teen years and whatever, I was much more permissive in my critical thinking. So, you know, I believed in crystals and crystal healing and, you know, energy modalities and phrenology and astrology and all the rest of it. And I didn't really filter those things. They all sounded groovy, right? They were all like fun stuff. I mean, it's fun to believe in the supernatural and pixies and fairies and goblins and ghosts. But on reflection, you find that there's really not much evidence for any of that.
Yeah.
So over the years, I guess I started reading more skeptical literature, you know, started reading Sam Harris and Hitchens and Dawkins and all these people, for, you know, skeptics, basically. And it all made sense. And then I would just ask myself the question, I wonder if that's true. So when something came up and somebody said they'd just been healed by the power of a pixie, I would say, I wonder if that's true. And that question starts a chain reaction. And you quickly realize that none of these things really hold up under any kind of critical lens. So, you know, over time, I've become more and more skeptical. And now I just require evidence. Yeah. I don't claim to have a lot of beliefs. I don't think actually the whole system of belief to me is a kind of a useless pursuit. It doesn't matter what you believe. It makes no difference at all, only to you. But as far as the truth goes, you know, you can believe something or you can not believe it. But the fact remains, it's either true or not. I mean, it's either real. This thing is either real or it's not real. That's a scientific question. Is it real or is it not? Or does it do this or does it do that? And to find out, you have to test it and you have to use the tools of science and find out. And we can get a pretty good idea about a lot of things, not everything. But, you know, the things we don't know about, we just admit that we don't know about. And that's fine, too. But we do have a tendency to make stuff up.
Yeah.
You know, when we don't understand things, we just tend to make things up and then we stick to that and then we build on that and we build on a house of cards and we end up believing a lot of things that aren't true. And I have a lot of friends that I have these conversations with all the time. I say, really? You think that's true? What kind of evidence is there for that? You know, and generally there's none.
Yeah. Well, there certainly seems to be sort of an endemic problem of mistaking belief for reality. And you know, this is really widespread in psychedelic culture, this idea of really respecting everybody's beliefs and that, you know, the sort of this philosophical view that everything is just a belief and there is no such thing as knowledge or there's no such thing as, you know, objective observation. And so it's all just a free for all and we're all free to believe whatever we want and your beliefs are just as true as my beliefs. And it is something that just so rubs me the wrong way.
Yeah, me too. I don't want to live in a universe that chaotic or that, you know, a society with that chaotic. Everything is, you know, meaningless and everything is meaningful and you just get to choose and pick and just make up your reality. I think we do have some very good tools to figure out what's real and what's not. And I think we need to use those tools. I think it would make right now, I mean, look at the mess we're in as a global society in so many ways. A lot of it's just based on irrational thinking.
Yeah.
I mean, even something as, you know, it's like climate change is probably our biggest problem right now. If we could just agree on the facts, then we could move forward, right? And we do have the solutions to most of these problems, but we can't agree on the facts. And that's a big, major problem.
Yeah, it really hinders any kind of effective action that we might take. If someone can just say, well, I don't believe in climate change, or my religion says that, you know, it's not a problem, then it's just an impasse where then how do we actually construct positive solutions to these issues that are impacting us if people won't even accept the reality of it and just want to fall back into some kind of cushy belief system?
Yeah, yeah. And without that, if you just use critical thinking, if everybody does that and is reasonable and rational and uses the tools of critical thinking, we all come to the same conclusions about these problems because they're fairly logical. You say, okay, this is the problem. This is what causes it. This is what we do to solve it. And then we work towards that. It's not a difficult problem. It's only difficult because everybody has a different view of reality. Everybody's living in a separate universe.
Yeah.
This is a big problem. In a lot of different areas, right?
Yeah, I would definitely agree with you on that. It seems like really you kind of undertook a self-education process. I mean, certainly within the book, you mentioned a lot about literature and Stoic philosophy, and, you know, kind of going, I believe you have a chapter about kind of just going into bookstores. So what was that self-education process for you? You know, it seems like you're kind of led by your curiosity.
Yeah. And it was very, very self-directed and, you know, autodidactic, because I went to a very horrible school where I didn't learn a single useful thing.
Yeah.
So we were bullied and belittled and pushed around. And I spent the whole of my school years with my blinkers on, trying to keep my head down, trying to stay out of trouble, and didn't learn a single useful thing. So when I left school, I'd never read a book. And from that time on, I just got curious and started going to the library. I don't know what, I guess somebody gave me a book or something, I got interested in it, but I used to go to the library and go to the literature section and started reading the great writers of the past, and was incredibly inspiring. I learned more from fiction than I ever did from nonfiction.
Yeah, you know,
that set off a whole chain reaction. Like, and then I just got this voracious appetite. So I'd find an author like, you know, Kurt Vonnegut or Steinbeck or Gogol or whatever, and then I'd read everything they'd ever written.
Mm.
Yeah. So there's a bit of obsessive compulsiveness in there, I think, too, which has served me well.
Yeah, well, it's great to just dig into somebody's complete work and really discover what they have to say. But something that I've mentioned in interviews that I've given, and I've probably also mentioned it here on the podcast, but just a memory for myself that comes up when you mentioned that you learn more from fiction than you did in school, that for me, an event that I had like that back in high school, which also I felt like for the most part, I never learned anything in school. I mean, it was a waste of time. But somewhere in high school, I read Frank Herbert's Dune.
Uh-huh.
And in reading that book, I felt that I came to understand religion, politics, and ecology far more than anything else I had ever learned, because it was all just put out there in this way, in this very dynamic story. It's like, oh, now I understand how politicians manipulate the public and the message and the way that religion and ecology all blends in together, and economics and power structures. That for me, it was just a revelation in reading that book. It's like, oh, okay, now this is so much more interesting than, you know, like American history class, where basically you're just learning lists of facts and dates and names that's just worthless, that has no overarching interpretation or anything.
Right. And I had the same experience, that I would be inspired by fiction in so many ways, but I was also being inspired by the writing. I was fascinated by the rhythm and the pattern of the writing and how it achieved the effects it did, like how it made me think, how it inspired me, basically, and what the mechanics of the writing were. So when I read books now, I'm almost, it's what the characters and the situations and what happens is almost irrelevant. I'm reading the writing.
Mm.
So that's what's most interesting to me, is the rhythm of the language. And when you read, you know, something like Hemingway or Vonnegut or, Tom Robbins, and you get this sense that of their enjoyment of writing. And I'm getting that from the reading.
Yeah. Boy, Tom Robbins, I mean, if there were ever a writer I could be like, I mean, that would be the one. I love his books so much.
Yeah.
I love his sense of humor, and his creativity and his use of language is just fantastic.
Yes, yes.
And Basil. I think that you have a very nice style yourself, that, you know, it's a lengthy book, you know, we're over 300 pages. It's a nice small font. So there's a lot in there, but the pacing of it and everything, I just really felt like I just want to keep reading. I want to keep reading. I loved having the opportunity to fill my spare time and my little extra windows of time that I had here and there over the past couple of weeks. Just like, oh, I'm so excited to get to read another chapter. And just really like the flow of the book. So maybe let's get more now into your story. We can all tell by your accent that, well, you're not from Vancouver. So let's kind of get into that and get into your story of how you grew up and then how you decided that psychedelics and smart drugs rather than the dumb drugs were the thing, and then how you built a life around that that gave you all these opportunities to travel and explore and pursue really radically different career paths along the way.
Yeah. Well, I came from a very backward place in southern England. It was called Crawley Newtown, and it was a satellite town from London. And these towns were built around London to be, you know, basically places where the overflow from London would live. And they were all planned with little, but, you know, rows of stores in the town square. And it was all, you know, probably looked great on paper, but it was an urban planning disaster. Mm. So we ended up with a lot of urban crime, a lot of dissatisfied, you know, disgruntled people, and the highest number of registered drug addicts in the British Isles. So it was just an experiment that didn't really work. The schools were massive. The education system was super heavy-handed and inadequate and inefficient. And everybody was basically groomed to work in the factory estate. It was a giant factory estate, and everybody went to work at the factory estate every day. And my parents did, and everybody's parents did, and then everybody's children went there.
Yeah.
So I knew from day one that I wasn't going to do that. It just looked like a horrible option. So I just figured there must be something better somewhere else. So as soon as I was old enough, I left town. When I was 15 years old, I left school. And I left town and I went to the south coast of England, to a much more progressive town, which is Brighton. It's a much more cosmopolitan town. There's a lot of foreign students, and there's an art scene, and there's alternative culture. And that's where I discovered psychedelics.
And what year would that be?
72.
Ah. Year of my birth. So you were 15 at that point?
Right.
Okay.
And yeah.
Yeah. So then what was the scene like in 1972 in Brighton?
Oh, it was a real eye-opener. after Crawley, it was a completely different scene. It was like freedom. There were so many different things going on. There was an art scene. There was theater. There was music. There were live music in all the pubs and bars. There was a lot going on, and a lot of it was also the drug capital. It was also the gay capital of England. So when I was first there, I was roomed with a gay waiter. So everybody I knew for the first year was gay. And that was, we go to gay clubs and gay pubs and gay restaurants and gay everything. And I would get introduced as, this is my straight friend.
Yeah.
And funnily enough, nobody ever really had a problem with that. It was like, you know, it was completely acceptable that I was straight and they were gay, and it was fine. There was never an issue. So it was fun because, I mean, you probably know as gay people, they really know how to have a good time.
Yeah.
So I went to a lot of great parties and had a good time and discovered pot, you know, marijuana. Well, actually, it was hash mainly at that time.
Yeah. There's a lot of hash in your book.
It was all hash in England from all through the 60s and 70s. It was pretty much 100% hash. Now and again, you get a little bit of grass, which was African. So it would either be Congolese or Malawi or Durban poison. And those would come up to England, but they'd be like pressed flat, all sticks and stems and black. But very, very strong, surprisingly strong. It's just as strong as the hash we were smoking, which was mostly Moroccan. And then from there, you know, more experimentations. And I describe in the book my first LSD trip, which was an absolute disaster. In fact, it's the only negative effect I've ever had with any drug at any time in my life was that first acid trip. And that was a bit of a disaster because I didn't know what it was. I'd never heard of LSD at the time. We didn't know what it was. We were just at the pub. Somebody said, here, you want some trips, man? And we said, sure. You know, we were just experimenting with a lot of different things. So we just popped these purple microdots, about 400 micrograms of LSD. And we really had no idea what was going to happen. And what happened was the whole world changed. We had no reference to normal, you know, reality at that point.
Yeah.
It was a very, very powerful experience. The interesting thing is that one of the films that I researched was on false memory syndrome, and I did a lot of research and interviewed all the memory, the memory experts in the world. And one of the things that came up about that was the unreliability of memory. You know, we've all heard that you have a memory, and then every time you recall it, you embellish it a little bit more, and that becomes your original memory. And this goes on. The thing about that first acid trip is I related it to a friend of mine 2 days after it happened. And I sent him a copy of the book in England. And he recently just wrote me back last week. He called me and he said that description of that trip was exactly word for word what I had described 2 days after the experience. And that was a bit of an eye opener, because I'd wondered how it would have changed over the years. But
yeah, quite interesting.
But it didn't.
Yeah,
so
made a
some
huge
memories
impact.
Are pristine.
Yeah.
Well, you take know, that, memory experts.
Yeah. But, you know, it's interesting with, it seems to often be with sort of these disconcerting psychedelic experiences where, you know, there doesn't seem to be that embellishment that you're talking about. And that, you know, I do consultations with people, and a lot of times it's with people that, you know, that maybe they had a psychedelic experience when they were very, very young, and now much later in life, they're coming back to it. And a common theme for many people is if they had a bad experience or a challenging experience like you had when they were younger, that it just, the whole thing shows up again later in life. And they're saying like, wow, it's like I was right back in where I was previously. So it does seem like that there's something about the impression of the psychedelic experience that kind of does get cemented, and it's not really subject to, as you say, sort of the embellishment and the editing that happens through other forms of memory, that there's something so visceral about it that it's almost like it gets embedded inside people's bodies in a way that then can then reoccur. Now, you've enjoyed psychedelics and all different kinds of drugs all the way through your life, so you haven't had that where, well, I did it once when I was young, and then I did it 30 years later, and it was back in the same thing. But it's just interesting how that seems to really implant within people in that way.
It's such a vivid memory. It's such a vivid experience that, I guess that creates a stronger memory.
Yeah.
But as far as reliving that, I mean, it was a nightmare at the time. But and I didn't really do anything for 2 years after that. But then, you know, I found myself on a beach in Morocco, and somebody said, "You want to try some acid?" And at that time, I knew all about it. I mean, I knew what it was. I knew what the point was. I knew what my intention was. I knew, you know, a lot more information. And I had a fantastic time. And like I said, I've never had a negative experience since that first time.
Yeah.
Not with anything, really.
So then in leaving England, so you just mentioned Morocco. So how did you find yourself in Morocco, and was that for the hash?
I guess that was part of it. It was part of a circuit. You know, there was a circuit around Europe and then around North Africa, and then there was a circuit through Istanbul to India, and they were the kind of the hippie trails, you know. Mm-hmm. So France was easy to get to from England, because you just jumped on the ferry, and for, you know, $20 you could be in France. So that was the first place we went to. I remember putting a map of Europe on my bedroom wall with a friend of mine, and we drew a line around it from England through France, through Amsterdam and Belgium, through Germany, down to, the south of France, down to the bottom of Italy. And we drew this line all the way around, this meandering route all the way out through Europe and then back down to Morocco. And we pretty much did that. we just followed the map. And then, of course, there'd always be the side trip where people would say, "Oh, you should go to this place because this thing is happening." And so we'd just go, you know. And then that person dropped off, and then I'd travel with another person. It just kept going for years. Went wherever the wind was blowing, basically. There was no great plan to it.
And prior to all this, I mean, as you were growing up in this factory town, did you have dreams of traveling? Was this an ambition, or you just kind of fell into it and found that you loved it and kept doing it?
Well, my earliest memory, I think, was that I wanted to travel the world and be a bongo player. Yeah. So, and I did that. So, it was a plan, a dream kind of thing. I wanted to travel. I was interested in other cultures. I just knew that the one that I was in was stagnant. Mm. It was, you know, everyone was poor. Everyone was angry. There was a lot of racism. It was horrible. It was a horrible place. There was violence in the street. There were roaming gangs of skinheads trying to kill each other. And there were mods and rockers trying to kill each other. So it was just like there had to be a better place than that. And I thought, if I go to other countries, it's got to be different, because everywhere can't be like this. And it wasn't. Almost everywhere I went was better.
Yeah, and eventually you swore off England, but as you've mentioned, you have gone back. So I know that in your book you talk about how much it changed. But so a young person traveling through Europe, going on the hippie trail, what was it like getting to Morocco and experiencing the culture in Morocco, and then also the other hippies there? Like, tell us a little bit about the scene.
Well, it was very different, because Europe is, there's similarities, you know, the culture in Europe is, it does change quite a bit, you know, between Italy and Germany and France and these different places, there's different cultures. And at the time, they all had different money as well. So every time you went across the border, you changed your money and it was a completely different monetary system. Now it's all the euro. That was a surprise for me, you know, when I started going back a few years ago. It's like everywhere is using euros. There's no more lira. There's no more Deutschmarks. There's no more French francs and Spanish pesetas. Anyway, so Morocco was a different thing. As soon as you get into North Africa there, Morocco was like going back in time. It was like, back in history, like to biblical times or something. There were camels and strange clothes and hooded people and dark streets. And, you know, it was a real trip. But at that time, the Moroccans were very tolerant, because they saw tourism as a resource, and we were spending money, and they liked that, and they liked to service the tourists. So they liked to get your money in any way they could too. If they could trick you out of it, they would do that as well, because they knew you'd just go back and get some more. So there was that kind of dynamic. But there wasn't the kind of tension between, you know, Westerners and Muslims that there is now. I don't know if you could have the same kind of experience now in a Muslim country, because there's a lot of anti-Western sentiment. And there wasn't at the time.
Yeah.
They were actually very friendly.
Yeah, I was going to say that's something that stood out to me in reading the book. I was kind of imagining, like, wow, I don't think anybody could really do that today, like go on these travels. That there's so much tension. There's so much animosity. There's been so much polarization that just the idea of, well, I'm just hitchhiking my way through the Middle East. It's like, wow, I don't see that happening. Or even just taking a bus, you know, across all these different borders and through these different countries. It just seems like maybe that's a world gone by, or hopefully it'll happen again. But yeah, it's a very different world. So it's such an interesting window into all of this. And then throughout all of it, you're busy smuggling drugs and people are trying to scam you. And I it's one of the things that I've done in my life is I have taught English to international students for many years. It's been a while since I've done that, but it's funny. I really laughed when you said, well, there's always somebody named Mohammed you could buy hash from. And it's just, I have had so many students with the name Mohammed. And one of the things that I would like to say is that all the students that I've had from the Middle East have just been the most overwhelmingly friendly, gracious, hospitable. I mean, they want to have you over for dinner. They want to make sure you're taken care of. I mean, just really, really wonderful people.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a tradition. So, you know, it's a tradition in a lot of those countries, a lot of North African countries and Middle Eastern countries is hospitality, right? It's huge. If a stranger comes to your house and you don't lavish them with, you know, hospitality and gifts and food, you're looked down upon. That's it's not done. You don't want to be in that position. So it's almost like an imperative, cultural imperative, that you have to do that. And so everybody does. So it's great, you know. You'll be in a little village in Turkey and the bus would break down and people would appear out of the darkness and they'd, you know, beckon you off and you'd go to the village and everybody would come together and all the food would come in and the musical instruments and the, everybody would just pile in and it would end up being a big party. It was great. You could do that almost anywhere, you know, almost anywhere through Turkey and Iraq and Iran and Pakistan and any of those places. They would just, you know, be very, very welcoming. And I'm not sure it's the same these days.
Yeah, yeah. So tell us a little bit about smuggling and how that works. And I really love that, you know, in several times in the book, and this is something that I've heard from other people, particularly people who are involved in bringing ayahuasca up from South America up into North America. Something that I hear a lot from people is, well, I don't feel that I'm doing anything wrong. I don't agree with the laws. I think that the laws themselves are immoral, and that something about having that attitude actually keeps you off the radar.
I think that's true. Yeah, I think that's true. I think if you're confident that you're not doing anything wrong, then because very often the whole game at a border is they're trying to pick up signals. So they throw signals at you and they try to get, you know, whatever you give back to them. That's at least they're looking for flags, they're looking for red flags, they're looking for behaviors, they're looking for defensiveness and all that thing. And if you're completely confident in yourself that you're not doing anything wrong, then you give off that vibe, and then they lose interest in you very quickly.
Yeah. So with bringing hash back and things like that, tell us a little bit about how that's accomplished. And actually, maybe we should get into what do you mean by an ethical drug dealer and that sort of self-identification that you've created for yourself, which I think is totally legit with what you have in the book. But what does that mean?
Well, I mean, a lot of, you know, drug dealer is a loaded term. A lot of people have a super neg. I mean, I hear people talk about drugs all the time. It's drugs this and drugs that and blah, blah. And I go, what drugs? What drugs are you talking about? There's a big difference, you know, between a gram of mushrooms and a flap of crack. So people have to know the difference between these drugs. There isn't one kind of drugs, and there isn't one drug problem. There isn't one drug kind of drug dealer. So there are a lot of drugs that I would never deal. And I've always dealt the drugs that I thought would be could actually be good for people, could actually increase their perception and awareness of the world and turn them into better human beings. And that's why I've considered myself an ethical drug dealer, because I've dealt with the psychedelics, and that's, you know, acid and LSD and psilocybin, DMT, and the, you know, the pure psychedelics. And I've never dealt in any of the, I've never dealt with coke or opiates or crack or any of that stuff, because those things are just, you know, seem to be not useful for human growth. So I consider psychedelics to be, you know, good for people. If they're used responsibly and respectfully, then I think the ultimate goal is to increase your perception and awareness of the world, and therefore make you a better person, and therefore make the world a better place.
Yeah.
So that's the ethical part. And yeah, there's a lot of confusion when people talk about drugs. You've got to be specific about what drugs you're talking about and how you're using them. Because you can use psychedelics irresponsibly as well. Well, you can use dumb drugs smartly and become a smart person doing smart drugs. This is all outlined in the book.
Yes, it definitely is. And I like that you also established your own boundaries as a dealer, that, you know, you talk about how, well, these are my operating hours. And so, no, I don't want people showing up at, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning. And also that you knew all of your clientele, and that you wanted to establish relationships with people, that there'd be mutual trust, there'd be mutual respect, and that's a lot different than buying something from somebody on the corner or showing up at somebody's house that you've never met and not knowing what you get. And that seemed to be a very important part of your story, that it's not just about dealing the drugs, but it's also the relationships and the experiences that you're having with other people and ways that you're growing and sharing life together.
Exactly. And I did know most of the people that I was selling to, or they, you know, they would be friends of friends. A lot of professional people. I mean, I sold to doctors and lawyers and dentists and government officials and, you know, all these people. There's an awful lot of people using psychedelics that people don't realize, you know.
Yeah.
Even people, oh, I'm against psychedelics. Well, you'd be surprised how many people in your life are using them that you don't know about. And hopefully in a positive way, right?
Yeah, it's certainly not limited to, you know, just the stereotypical hippie or counterculturalist or something like that. And I think it's especially true with psychedelics, that they're actually widely used by people in positions of authority and respectable positions within society, doctors, scientists, professors, you know, that it's not, it's not foreign to these professions in any way.
I outlined some of that in the book, but I mean, again, it's another area where there's so much material that you could do a whole, you could do, you know, volumes of books on just that subject, on the influence of psychedelics in culture and science and technology, because a lot of computer science, Silicon Valley, everybody was, I mean, even today, everybody's low dosing LSD and psilocybin now. Before they were doing larger doses. I mean, Microsoft was founded on psychedelics. So were a lot of major breakthroughs in technology, a lot of major breakthroughs in physics, chemistry, all kinds of areas of science. A lot of these people through the 60s and 70s, they were all getting influenced and inspired and solving these major problems through the psychedelic experience, because it opened their minds up and it made them think in new and novel ways that they hadn't done before. So they'd be working on this problem. You know, the guy that invented virtual reality, language, all kinds of, there's all kinds of examples. In fact, MAPS had a newsletter a number of years ago, and they got all these guys that had made major breakthroughs in chemistry and physics and biology and all these different areas. And now that they're all retired, they could finally, you know, confess that, yes, actually, this major breakthrough and this problem that we saw, it was all done with LSD and psilocybin. It's amazing, really. You think of it, all these things in our culture that have been inspired by that. And that's not even, you know, that's not even to start on culture and the culture and music and philosophy and art and all that. But it's been a huge influence, a massive influence, but generally an underground one, mostly. But right now we're on the verge of, you know, as you well know, that we're on the verge of a psychedelic psychotherapy revolution, and these things are being used and tested and studied all around the world now. So in the coming years, in the coming decade, there's going to be an explosion of uses for psychedelics which we've never had before, because they've been illegal. So they'll gradually become more and more legal, as all drugs are. In Canada now we have legal marijuana, recreational marijuana, right across the board. So we've just, some places are legalizing mushrooms now on a local level. So it's begun, you know, the dominoes are falling, and you can see where it's going to go, right?
Yeah, I think Canada has been particularly progressive in that area. And also here, I'm in the state of Oregon, and I know you know that we recently passed our psilocybin services initiative, and they've also basically decriminalized personal possession of all drugs here in Oregon. So rather than putting people in prison, they actually, for people who have trouble, we're steering them towards healthcare solutions, and then also really recognizing that there's lots of therapeutic potential. And also here in Ashland, where I live, you know, we have the Santo Daime Church, where you can legally go drink ayahuasca. One of the few places in the United States where it's actually been recognized as a legal right. So,
right. So the dominoes are falling, and one thing leads to another. That's what happened with the marijuana, right? They started to legalize it at the municipal levels, and then that spread, and then there was the chinks, and then there was the medical marijuana, which created a gray area. So the same thing is happening with psychedelics now. It's the same kind of formula. And we'll see more and more legalization and more uses, more and more studies. And that's going to be a good thing.
Yeah. So let's talk about music. I actually meant, but I didn't. I spaced it. I meant to go and check out some of your music that you mentioned. So I didn't get a chance to do that. But certainly music is a major theme throughout much of the book. You do talk about sort of your first experience of punk rock and just the unbridled raw energy of that, and then your absolute distaste for electronic music, and then discovering MDMA and the rave scene, and then you yourself as the bongo player and making music. So let's talk about music, and we can start anywhere you like. It's obviously it's a love and a passion for you. So
yeah. Since very early on, I mean, I think I got my first guitar when I was 15, and it was a super cheap guitar. It was like a $5 guitar, and couldn't tune it, couldn't play it. tried to play this thing and tried to learn some chords, couldn't do it, gave it up. And then 2 years later, I was hitchhiking around in Europe, and I met a guy on a campsite who was playing guitar kind of very, very well, but he wasn't much of a singer, so I would sing with him. And then I bought a guitar, and he taught me a few chords. And I was playing on the street about a week later. Found I could play three songs. I just played the same three songs over and over again, and found that I could make some money doing that. So I did that as a source of income for many years in different European countries. You could just go into any town in any place and set up on the corner, play your guitar, sing songs, and you get money. So that was a real boon. So I did that for many years, and. Most recently, I've been making. Well, I mean, I've done a lot of performing. I've done a lot of coffee shops and solos, duos, trios. I played with a five-piece jazz band in Guelph, Ontario, for a few years. And most recently, I made 26 music videos of my using my filmmaking background and the music background. So I did all my original songs, or 26 of the best ones. And made music videos, and they're all posted on YouTube under Jimmy Fritz. There's a YouTube channel called Jimmy Fritz.
Well, I'm gonna have to check it out.
Those
original three songs, do you remember what they were?
One of them was Dead Skunk by Loudon Wainwright.
Okay.
not
familiar with that song.
I got a dead skunk in the middle of the road. Dead skunk okay. in the middle of the road.
Oh, yes.
And it's stinking to high heaven.
Okay, yes. When I was young, I used to listen to the Dr. Demento radio
yes.
show. And that was in there. Also, Fish Heads.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm a great fan of Loudon Wainwright. He's a great songwriter. And what was the other one? Blowing in the Wind, Bob Dylan.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And the other one was The Spirit of New Orleans by Arlo Guthrie.
Oh, I'm not familiar with that song.
Yeah. They were simple three-chord songs, you know, C, G, 7, and F. And that was the start. So I'd play those three songs over and over again just because people are walking by, right? So they don't know you. They don't know you. You only know three songs.
Right. And that helped facilitate a lot of this travel. And then also making some more money on the side, but often you're working with hash, LSD. I mean, I love your descriptions of how to smuggle LSD, about why that's so convenient. And boy, the hash just seems a lot tougher with hash. And then, of course, when you're getting into pills and other things like that, you know, just the practicalities and where are you going to put it and whose body cavity are you going to use? How do you decide that?
Yeah, it's a bit hit and miss. The first time I smuggled hash oil from Morocco, we put it in condoms and we swallowed the balls. So we made it up into 28 balls of about 5 or 6 grams in each ball. And then we swallowed them. Which is actually very difficult.
Yeah, I can't imagine.
And when I look back on that now, I mean, I think I was like 19 years old at the time. So I don't think we had much of a concept of personal danger.
Yeah.
Or jeopardy. So I don't even know where we got that idea. I don't think I knew anybody that had done it before. I don't know whether I'd seen it in a movie, or I don't know where we got the idea from. It was... Suddenly, there we were, balling it up into condoms and swallowing it. Anyway, it worked out all right in the end.
And then, I mean, just at the practical level, so are you then in your destination? Are you sticking your fingers down your throat and, like, throwing this up? I mean, how do you get balls of condoms with hash out of your digestive tract. I mean, it's
They go straight the way through. passing go.
Okay, so you wait for the exit then.
Yeah, you take cling film and put it over the toilet and make holes in it. Carry on. It's not pleasant, but it works. Yeah. You don't want to swallow them a second time, I tell you that.
certainly not. A major recurring theme throughout the book is raves and the electronic music scene and really your love for it. I mean, like we've already talked about, you got into film, so you decided you went to film school and started making film. And then you went to a rave and it's like, oh, I want to do this. And you've done some DJing and you have some nice insights about DJs, about what makes a good DJ versus a bad DJ. And, you know, that most of the knob turning is just for show anyway, but
DJs are gonna hate me for this book, I tell you. I have a lot of friends who are DJs and they're not gonna be pleased about that chapter.
Yeah, you know, I know a lot of DJs who their whole playlist, it's all set up beforehand. And really, you know, everything that they're doing, that it's like, oh, I got my headphones on and I'm adjusting this knob. They're not really adjusting anything.
Yeah, at most, that's beat matching.
Yeah.
Choosing a track and beat matching, that's the main skill. The rest of it is just, I mean, I have people say to me, oh, I'm going to see this DJ, he's a musical genius. And I say, no, actually, he can't play an instrument, doesn't know anything about music, he's actually just playing records. Which is fine, you know, I mean, I have a great time at these parties, but no, that musical geniuses, they're not. Sometimes they are music, you know, someone like, Paul Van Dyk is also, you know, a very talented composer. So he has made some pretty impressive pieces of music. But that's a different skill. The DJ is, you know, presenting other people's music generally. They're just playing records, or now they're just playing MP3s or FLAC files or whatever. So they just cue them all up and off you go.
Yeah, but it really makes a difference in terms of song selection, style, how people, you know, like a good DJ definitely takes people on a journey and it moves them through like different levels of energy and beats and textures and maybe brings them back down versus, you know, some DJs that, oh my God, it's just a bunch of noise and it's dissonant and it's too loud or it's too fast. So there's definitely an art to it, but it's different than being a musician. It's different than being a composer for most of them. But it seems to be something that you yourself mastered. And I like how you wrote about how, well, these were my directions that I gave to the DJs. So tell us a little bit about that and how you wanted the rave to be structured in order to maximize the experience.
Well, it was important for me that the music worked in a certain way. So it wasn't just the case. Some people do parties like that. They just do a party, they get the sound system, and then they just hire five of their friends for DJs, and they say, go do what you want. And that rarely works that well, because the DJs are not working together, and you don't get this seamless blend of music from one to the other, and they're mixing up the genres, and the whole vibe changes. You change them. I mean, if you're playing a progressive house tracks, and you drop in a drum and bass track, you will empty the dance floor. You can just see people walking off. So you don't want that. You want to create this. And that's what that was the experience I had when I went to my first raves. I was lucky enough to go to some really good ones. And they created that seamless musical journey, this group mind experience, together with the MDMA, that created this really powerful transpersonal journey through the night and to an ending. And so that's what I wanted to do. So I worked with the DJs and said, okay, we're going to start, you know, these BPMs. We're going to progress from this genre to this genre and end up at this spot and then make these seamless blends. And it worked every time. It was fantastic. And we had some incredible, incredible experiences, life-changing experiences for a lot of people. I did about 30 different events. I did one a month for about 30 months. And I would see people's lives change in overnight. It was incredible, the effect that these parties had. It was a very tight-knit group of people, too. Mm. We had a society called the Society for the Perpetuation of Empathogenic Celebrations. It was called SPEC. So they were spec projects. It was a term that I got from filmmaking. A spec project is one you make on spec, right, to get another project or a budget. So we called them spec projects. So we had the Solstice spec project and the Halloween spec project and the Christmas spec project. So we had about 300 people on an email list, which made it for a very, very tight-knit group. Everybody knew everybody, and everybody over the months, everybody got to know everybody. So it was basically a group of tight-knit friends. We didn't have people come into the bar. We closed the doors at 1 o'clock, so nobody came in from the bar scene. And we had this super tight group of people, and it was a membership-based system. So we had membership cards. So it's Society of Perpetuation of Passive Eugenic Celebrations, and then you had your name on it and sign it. We had a security feature on the back with textured paper. And then you had to be, and it said so-and-so is certified 100% cool and groovy. So all the members had to be certified 100% cool and groovy, which was by me. And, you know, we know who those people are, right? So that was it. It was handpicked. It was a handpicked crew of really responsible, intelligent, you know, psychonauts who got it, who were on the same page. So yeah, we had no alcohol. It was all just Ian, Progressive House, and Trance, and it was a fantastic experiment. It worked really, really well.
Yeah, and it seems like you also got yourself into a maybe I wouldn't say trouble, but how. You talk about how that certain promoters were trying to say, oh, no, it's not about taking drugs and dancing. You know, these are clean events. And that you gave an interview and you're like, no, it's all about the drugs and the music. It all goes together. It's all part. This is why we're doing this.
So kind it of was a political position because raves were kind of under fire and people were critical and they were thinking, oh, what's going on? And there was a lot of stuff in the press about, you know, rampant drug use. And there were events like that, but not our events. So to me, it was essential to MDMA was an essential part of rave culture. The music wouldn't have happened. The music was created by gay DJs in gay clubs on E. You know, that's where it came from. And they were, you know, the E was, you get this rush with E, and that was reflected in the music. So the music was influenced by the MDMA. The whole culture was influenced by it. And the rave experience itself of being in this one group mind experience and everybody connected in the moment, in this magic moment together, was essential for MDMA was essential to that experience. So I didn't want to whitewash it. And the other promoters were saying, oh, you know, we have most people are sober and we're just getting high on the music and blah, 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 you know. And that was the party line. So I kind of broke free of that and said, no, actually, MDMA is essential to this experience. And it's important that people know that because it's a good thing. It's a fantastic thing. And people's lives get changed for the better. And I've seen it happen. Like, I can't count the amount of times I've seen people's lives improve and their connection with themselves or their connection with their family or their partners and stuff just take off like a rocket after that experience. So it is essential to the experience. And I thought it was important to emphasize that. So I did in my book, Rave Culture, an insider's overview, which I wrote after having that, because I was so impressed with the experience, I thought, I got to tell the world about this. So I wrote that book about 20 years ago. It's just been re-released, actually, on Amazon as a paperback and an e-book, because I ran out of print copies, and then I've just carried on now the print-on-demand and e-book.
Yeah, well, print-on-demand works great. I love
it's
it.
It's fantastic, isn't it?
Yeah. No upfront cost to the author, and then it's available, and Amazon takes care of it. I mean, we're making Jeff Bezos richer, so, you know. But the convenience is fantastic. It's so easy to put your material out, and then you get to control it and update it as much as you want or need to. But, I'll have to check out that book. I love how it kind of became a passport for you.
Yes.
Going around the world. Like, well, hello, you don't know me, but here's my book. And it seemed like it really opened a lot of doors for
it
you.
It did. I used to send it to promoters when we went to a country. I'd send it to the promoter before we went. I'd get on the net, find out who they were, send them, say, hey, I'm a rave promoter from Canada. I wrote this book. Here, have a read. And we're coming at this date. And if anything's going on, let us know. And it was a passport to a good time for sure. People would invite us in. They'd do events for us. They'd do a club night for us or put on a beach party or something. So it was great. It was a passport for sure.
Yeah. And you did talk a lot about the Goa scene in India. Just kind of curious, like, what did it feel like? That was an extension of rave culture that was happening elsewhere, or was it kind of its own scene? I mean, I am not good with EDM genre distinctions. So I know that there is Goa trance, but I would not be able to pick it out of a musical lineup.
Right. So it's basically house music. It's progressive house music with Indian samples and with a more kind of trippy psychedelic feel to it. And of course, it's much faster. And that's one of the unique things, like 140 beats per minute or more. So it's hard and fast. And Goa trance and Psy trance. Goa trance was first, and Psy trance was even harder and faster. But they all came from an evolution of house music, which started in Chicago, then went to Detroit and became techno. And those two branched out, and there's techno forms that came from that. There's the house, all the house forms came from that. And then the breakbeat forms came down the middle from hip hop through jungle and drum and bass and all those forms. So there's basically, you know, four rhythmic structures which everything comes from. They're either, it's either house music, techno, or breakbeat. Those are the three main ones. And then there's all the, like, the ambient, down tempo, and whatnot. But they're all also based on those main three rhythmic structures.
Hmm. And then here on the West Coast, everything is dubstep these days.
Oh, that's a breakbeat form, yeah.
Okay.
So that came from the breakbeats with the hip hop, you know, bass. So all the kids that grew up on hip hop really go for dubstep, right? And all the people that grew up on rock and roll go for the 4/4 house music and techno.
Yeah.
And that's the difference. I was never a big hip hop fan. I was never really a fan of hip hop music and breakbeats in general, a syncopated rhythm. It's kind of hard to dance to. And,
yeah.
But it's massively popular. And so all those breakbeat forms came off of that, the drum and bass, the jungle, and now the dubstep, right? And two step and trip step and hop step and jump step. All the rest of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely beyond my scope. Like I said, I don't know enough about the different names or the different genres to really distinguish any of that. I was never part of the rave scene. That kind of the closest I've ever come has been Burning Man, which is just its own beast entirely.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, I listen to a lot of this stuff, but I'm just totally ignorant about what the actual genres are.
Yeah, no, it's true for a lot of people, but it's actually not that complicated once you know the basic rhythmic structures and then the story of how they, you know, develop. So if something has a techno rhythm, it's tech something. If it has a, you know, house sounds on top of that, it's tech house, you know, etc. So there is a logic and a taxonomy to all the genres that you can identify.
Yeah,
if you learn the different forms.
Yeah, I've definitely seen some interesting spreadsheets online that show main genres and then branches off, and you get to see sort of the whole evolution of how one form of music went into another, and then had the cross pollination from the Caribbean to England, then, you know, to here to there, and you get all that stuff that I think is fascinating.
Yeah, it is, and you can do those charts for, you know, heavy metal music or rock and roll or any other genre too. They all have a family tree. They all have a very, very specific family tree that you can trace everything back and see where it came from.
Yeah. Well, it's been a while since I've been to Burning Man, but I was there when the oil rig exploded.
Yeah,
which
yeah.
is featured in your book. And so I was like, oh, yeah, wow, I remember that one, man.
That was something else, eh?
Wasn't it? I mean, I have never seen an explosion that big in real life. I mean, that was just like, that was unreal. It was like a mushroom cloud.
Yeah, and the amazing thing was is it was in the middle of a crowd of like 60,000 people. Yeah. So you've got this sea of people, and I was looking out, and then all of a sudden this mushroom cloud went up in the middle. I thought, my God, that's gonna, how many people is that going to kill? But apparently it was the biggest propane explosion ever ignited. And the Guinness Book of Records were there. They were there to record it. And it went into the Guinness Book of Records as the biggest propane explosion. So I guess the thing with propane is it goes up and it looks impressive, but it doesn't give – it gives heat, but it doesn't give a lot of – it doesn't give much of a shock wave.
Yeah.
But it looked like Hiroshima. It looked like
– it sure did.
Looked like an atomic bomb going off.
Yeah, I was way on the other side of the playa on top of a piece of art at the time. And even from there, I mean, it was still huge. And I later found out that a friend of mine – one of my campmates, that he was on peyote and LSD, and he was seated at the very front everyone gathered around. And he said it was quite something for that perspective. I mean, I can't even imagine. I mean, from where I was, it was already impressive. I don't know if I was tripping at the time or not. I mean, it was Burning Man. There's a good chance that maybe I was, but I just remember it's like, oh my God, look at that.
Yeah, that was something else. I had friends who were just behind the safety rope too, and a fun friend of mine had his eyebrows singed off.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So I guess they were not quite far enough away. Yeah, he had a close shave.
Yeah. So, just in your estimation, like, what's the difference? You know, for people who've never been, like, what's the difference between a rave and Burning Man?
Well, a rave is a very specific sort of event based around a DJ, based around a certain kind of music and a certain ethos, and people do MDA and they dance through the night into the morning. Burning Man is a completely different animal. It's totally unique, and it's not unlike, you know, it's not really comparable to any other type of festival or event. But it's more of a festival in that it's a lot of different things. You know, you got the red light areas and you got the meditating yogic neighborhoods, and you've got the tech people, you've got this technology aspect to it, you've got this fantasy cosplay thing going on, you've got all these different things. I mean, it's basically an explosion of creativity and individuality. So, you know, there are crossovers with rave, they have those elements too, but rave is a much more focused event on one type of experience. Whereas Burning Man, you can, you know, it's like you can go anywhere, go do anything there. It's a very unique event. It's not really like anything else. It's not like any other festival in the world for many reasons. You know, one is the gifting society and the lack of money on the site, and everything's free. People bring it, you know, everybody brings something, and they're doing things to blow you. It blew my mind how much time and trouble people put into creating something. I think the Ouroboros was there. Well, that big Ouroboros there's six bicycles around this gigantic wooden wheel, and you cycle on the thing, and it goes around, and it creates this zoetropic effect with snakes and boats and people.
Yeah, and everybody had to be pedaling together. And
I mean, that's just mind blowing that somebody would build something like that just to blow people's minds, right?
Yeah.
And a lot of it was like that. I mean, some of those sculptures and stuff are coming on in, you know, six semi-trailers of stuff just to build this sculpture or whatever. And, it's astounding. It's an explosion of unfettered creativity. It's really inspiring. I was very inspired by Burning Man.
Yeah.
We have a very active local group here. We do an event called Otherworld every year. And it's the regional Burning Man event on Vancouver Island. And it's a fabulous event. It's really good too. So we've brought it back and kept the vibe alive.
Yeah. And such a universe away from a factory town in jolly old England, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a long way from Crawley to Burning Man.
Yeah. So you eventually made it back to England, and it seems like your appreciation for it changed a little bit.
So. Yeah, I hadn't been back in 25 years. And had no intention of going back. most of my family. My parents moved here to Canada. My sister went to South Africa. And so I really didn't have any reason to go back, but I did have some old school friends. And I reconnected with them through Facebook when Facebook first came out. I joined up and these people popped up on my Facebook and we said hi and blah, blah, blah. And we started messaging and I thought, maybe I'll just go back one more time and just do the rounds and see all these old friends and see what happened just for fun. So I did. And I was pleasantly surprised at the changes. It was really a much different place than I'd left. The place that I'd left was sort of depressed. You know, everybody was broke. Nobody had a car. Nobody had a telephone. Nobody went on vacations. It was like just a really austere type of working class environment. And a lot of violence and a lot of racism. So that had kind of, there's been an obvious shift. It's much more affluent, much more cosmopolitan. People seem to be, just in a better place. So I was very impressed with the changes, you know. All the good things, the pubs were still there and the good things were still happening, but all the negativity and the things that I didn't like about it, things I was trying to get away from, were actually much better. So it was great. And I went back for 5 years in a row after that. And kept going back and getting all these friends together in different places. And I got them all to do LSD one time on a barge. And, you know, it was great fun. It was really, really eye-opener.
Yeah.
It was a nice connection with the past, too.
Yeah, I was going to say,
Yeah,
I really like the story of taking that long barge boat through the canals. And then I think you said it was like a several day trip and then someone took the 20-minute drive.
Yeah, it was 7 days. It was like an epic journey through the dales and through this, you know, the landscape is moving constantly and changing. And you feel like you've been thousands of miles in 7 days and seven nights. And we finally arrive and my friend calls his sister and she's at the start point where we'd left 7 days ago. Took her 20 minutes to drive over for dinner.
Yeah. I'll be there in half an hour.
It's a fantastic way. If you ever get a chance to get on the canal barges in England, they're called narrow boats. And there's a 3,000 miles of canal systems all over England. If you've got the time, you can go great distances. But even if you don't, it's still a great experience. You just float by at 2 miles an hour, floating through the English countryside. And you see everything from the countryside, from the backside, rather than the towns, right? So it's a great way to get around. They're just recreational now. They used to be used for industrial purposes to get heavy goods around the country. Now they're 100% recreational. So you just pay it for a license for the year and you get to use all the resources. And there's they're recreational areas. So there's joggers on the jogging path and there's pubs every few miles. And it's a great, great trip if you ever get the chance to do that.
Yeah, and a great place to trip while on your trip.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
We got to one point where we had to go up 21 locks. So you go through locks and they raise you up, you know, around about 12 feet or whatever it is. And then you go along a little bit more and then you go up another one. So to get up this, basically a small mountain, there's 21 locks in a row. And it's quite a trip. You jump off the front of the boat and you crank the paddles and you fill the thing. And then you open the gates and you go through and you go up and then you shut the gates and then you let the water in again. And then you go through and this process goes on. It took us all day. From about 10 o'clock to about 4 o'clock in the afternoon to get up these 21 locks. And we did LSD in the morning, and we just flew up. We just flew up these locks. It was fantastic. It was a great day.
Yeah. It's not quite the same thing because it's, you know, not just traveling along. But I certainly enjoyed my time of munching on truffles and cruising around the canals of Amsterdam.
Oh yeah,
that was definitely delightful. You know, I've been to Europe like once. I've been to England and Ireland a couple times.
Yeah,
but other than that, haven't gotten around too much.
But in terms of discovery to do.
Yeah, in terms of Canada, Vancouver is the place I've been to the most.
And yeah,
I think it's a lovely city.
Yeah, it is. It is a nice city. It's gotten a lot bigger since we were first here like 25 years ago. And it's changed a lot. It's really built up.
Yeah.
But it's still got a lot of good things going for it, as far as cities go, right?
Yeah. And a strong psychedelic community there.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's a happening place.
Yeah. So I've kept you on for a while. If people want to find your book, obviously, we've got Amazon, Confessions of an Ethical Drug Dealer by Jimmy Fritz, a psychedelic travelogue and memoir. Do you have a website or other place that people can connect with you?
No, just the book title. If they just dial up the book title, they'll find it on Barnes & Noble and Kobo and eBooks and Apple Books and Google Books. And Rave Culture is also Rave Culture and Insider's Overview is also on Amazon.
And this was just released this year, correct?
Which one? The Confessions?
Yeah, Confessions.
Yeah, like 2 months ago.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
Brand new, hot off the press.
Yeah. Thank you so much for reaching out and sending me a copy. What's next? What's your next project or current project?
Well, I'm writing a book about somebody in a mental asylum who's a mute, who's railing against the world and planning their own suicide.
That sounds intriguing.
Another autobiographical novel. Yeah, it's going to be hilarious. It's a vehicle so that I can rant about everything.
Oh, good.
Because I got a lot of ranting to do.
Yeah, this well, one, let
this,
it out.
I did some ranting in this one, but this next one's going to be a lot of ranting. So I needed a structure to hang that on.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to do it completely nonfiction. So it's a novel, but the main character is called Fritz, and he's kind of basically beating the system in more ways than one, and plotting his own. So the whole book is a suicide note, basically.
Hmm. Well, sounds
going to be really funny.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, sir, your wit, it certainly comes through in Confessions of an Ethical Drug Dealer. And as I've mentioned, that I do think it's very insightful. And I like the way that you go about presenting your ideas and how it's woven in with your experiences and your attitude and all of it. It's great. I love the book.
Fabulous. Thanks a lot. It's good to hear.
Yeah. Well, it's been excellent talking to you.
Yeah, it's been fun. Today. It's been great.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for your time. And again, for sending me a copy of the book. I really appreciate that.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Okay.